The Buddhist Way to Peace of Mind. Chapter 1. A Golden Opportunity. We are very fortunate to be alive in a time where the genuine teachings of the Buddha are still available, and we are an exemplary few who take a sincere interest in studying them. This is a special and rare opportunity. The teachings of the Buddha are crystal clear, and the truth of them is verifiable in one's own experience. When we practice the Buddha's teachings, the Dhamma, we will see obvious and quick results. Upon understanding the Dhamma, many of the Buddha's disciples exclaimed, "It is crystal clear, as if something that was turned upside down is now right side up." It is easy. We turn something up that was face down. How hard could that be? The Buddha's teachings are so valuable, in the beginning, as they point us in the right direction, in the middle, as they make perfect sense, showing us what is right, what is wrong, and we can verify the truths for ourselves, and in the end, as we truly wash away the impurities in our hearts and minds, and suffering disappears, step by step. Buddhism teaches us to study ourself. And what do we consider to be ourself? Our body and mind, of course, are what we call ourself. So we need to study our body and our mind. The Buddha taught that we will suffer as a result of love. Anything we love will be the cause of our suffering. The things that we love the most are this body and mind of ours. Why do we love them? Because we think these things can bring happiness. For example, we love our eyes. We don't want to go blind. We want to see beautiful things. If our eyes could see only ugly and scary things, we wouldn't want to have eyes. Similarly, our ears let us hear nice sounds. If we could but hear only sounds we didn't want to hear, then we wouldn't want to have ears. Our sense organs, through which we see, hear, smell, taste, and touch, allow us to experience the outside world. They make us believe the world is valuable, that it can bring us happiness. When the world brings us pains and sorrows, we still keep dreaming up things to hope for. We are filled with hopes of permanent happiness, hopes of our situation being permanently good and our minds at peace. The truth is that all things are temporary. Since we wish for the impossible to occur, we inevitably suffer. Our wishes can never come true. When we start to examine this body and this mind, we will see that they are suffering, that they are nothing special at all. When we see this truth clearly, we will let go of all attachment to the body and mind. And once we are no longer attached to the mind, there will be no more attachment to anything at all. The goal of Buddhism is to be free from personal suffering. This is called enlightenment, or nirvana. There is no more suffering when we are no longer attached to the body and to the mind, because the body and the mind are what suffer. A person who has achieved this is called an arahant, or a fully enlightened being. Those who have attained enlightenment dwell in the truth. They see the truth of life, the truth of the world, the truth of the universe. The duty of Buddhists is to study the Dhamma until we see the truth and dwell in it as enlightened ones do. The first truth is called suffering. Suffering refers to the body and mind. Can we see that it is the body and mind that are suffering? No, we can't see that quite yet. We still think that the body is suffering sometimes, but happy at other times, and that the mind is suffering at times, but happy at other times. If we still see that the body and mind are only suffering sometimes and are happy at other times, then we will not let go of attachment to them. We will still think there is a chance to make them happy. We will still love and cherish them, so we keep struggling to make them content and comfortable. When we love and cherish the body and mind, then the cause of suffering occurs. The cause of suffering is desire, wanting and craving. What do we want? We want this body and this mind to be happy, and we want them to be free from suffering. Whenever there is wanting, the mind is not peaceful. It struggles, and whenever there is struggle, there is suffering. When we don't understand the truth of suffering, the cause of suffering is sure to arise. When desire arises, there is a struggle to get to some other state than the present state. A false reality is fabricated, an idea that something else is better, and this is created by the mind. The end of suffering will not be experienced. The end of suffering is nirvana. Nirvana is the unconditioned state where the mind is free from all fabrication, desire, and craving. The mind that attains nirvana is truly and completely at peace. We are to observe and know suffering. The body and mind are what the Buddha refers to as suffering. We are to know the body and mind until we see that they are suffering. The moment in which suffering is seen clearly is the moment that enables the truth to be completely realized. The way to know suffering that the Buddha taught is called the practice of vipassana. It is to know in a very special way the three characteristics of the body and mind. The three characteristics are that nothing is permanent, anicca, that nothing persists, dukkha, and that nothing can be controlled, anatta, or non-self. Chapter 2. The Buddha's Teachings. The Buddha taught that there are three areas that we must train in: moral training, mental training, and training in wisdom. The first area is training in morality. What do we do in order for our mind to be in its normal and natural state, where it is not being influenced by a harsh impurity like greed, anger, or ignorance to the point of speaking or acting immorally? When we experience the world through our eyes and ears, we need to have mindfulness, an awareness of what is going on in our hearts. If we can see the greed, anger, or ignorance, then with practice, it cannot take over our mind and cause us to be immoral. An example is if we are in a committed relationship and we see a beautiful woman at the park. We feel that we like her and desire her. Mindfulness can then see that craving has arisen in the heart. If there has been enough practice and the mindfulness is genuine, the craving will then disappear. We then will not deceive her or our partner in any way. We may see that she has a partner and feel angry or jealous and want to say or do something to hurt him. If mindfulness sees the anger cannot manipulate the mind. It will disappear, and no harm will be done. It is wonderful to have mindfulness that is able to keep us moral. But if our mindfulness is not yet strong enough to do all the work in keeping us from doing harm by itself, we still need to keep a proper moral standard, a set of rules to live by. We must be sure to not kill or harm any living being, to not steal, cheat, lie, or take alcohol or drugs for intoxication. And once we live a moral life, our meditation will benefit as well. The second area of training is mind, mental training. We need to train to attain the highly skillful and wholesome state of mind that practices vipassana meditation, that trains in wisdom. But first, we need to learn how to make mindfulness, which observes the body and mind, arise on its own. Mindfulness is the recognition of a phenomenon of body or mind. A phenomenon can be a feeling like happiness, a mental state like laziness, or a physical movement like nodding our head. Mindfulness will arise on its own when it sees a phenomenon that has been precisely memorized. How do we make mindfulness arise on its own? With practice. To practice being mindful of the body, simply notice when the body moves. Be aware when you breathe in. Be aware when you breathe out. Be aware when the stomach expands and contracts. Be aware when your body bends and stretches. To practice being mindful of the mind, learn to recognize pleasant and unpleasant feelings, mental states, and emotions. When there is anger, greed, or when we are lost in thought, we must notice that this is so. When the mind does not have anger, is not greedy, or isn't lost in thought, then we must notice that this is so. Let's keep noticing what mental states have arisen after they do. From practicing in this way, mindfulness will arise on its own eventually. It is important that we let the body and mind do what they do naturally, and then notice after the fact what they have done. For example, we nod our head when we are talking to someone, and then notice that our head moved. Or, we see food and greed arises in the heart, and then we know it has. If we get lost in thought, then we become aware that this has happened. Oh, the mind just wandered off. When we practice repeatedly seeing physical and mental phenomena as described, the mind starts to remember the states that we see. Eventually, our mind will have these states memorized so well that mindfulness will see them when they come up without any intention or effort on our part. Mindfulness will work on its own to see and know the workings of the body, mind, and heart. In Vipassana, mindfulness needs to be automatic, working on its own to see the true characteristics of what physical and mental phenomena arise. If the mindfulness is intentional, then it is a practice for calmness and not for seeing reality. Calmness meditation is called samatha. Examples are focusing in on the breath or the feet while walking. In order to see the true characteristics of mental and physical phenomena, we need to have the correct type of concentration where the mind is the stable observer or witness of whatever arises. There are a few different ways to achieve correct concentration, the stable observer. We'll talk about that soon. When the mind is stable and the body and mind separate from each other, it will be clear that the mind is the observer and the body is being observed. The body sits, breathes, stands, and moves around, and the mind is the observer. In Buddhism, when the truth can be seen, it is called wisdom. This is the third area of training. Once we have correct concentration from our mental training, the mind and body can separate for us to see. There will be the wisdom that we are not the body. The body will be seen merely as a physical mass and not a person. And regarding the mind, we will see the impurities of the mind like anger and greed come and go, like strangers walking by as we sit on our front porch. We need not meddle with them. They just pass by and then disappear. They have nothing to do with us. At the time of the Buddha, there were many spiritual teachers. Many of them could see that the body was not us, but they couldn't see that the mind was not us either. It is much harder to see that the mind is not us, because we have been attached to it for so long. The Buddha was very special and could teach people to see that they are not their minds. Even though this body is changing incessantly and is never stable, we still think there is a person in this body. We think that the child from before and the person now are the same. We have a misconception that we are a particular person, or on a deeper level, that we are our mind. It is hard to see that we are not our mind, but when we finally see this in our own experience and fully accept it to be true, then we enter the stream of enlightenment. In order to see that the mind is not us, we first need to become the stable observer and see that the body isn't us, that the sensations are not us, that all the positive and negative mental states and emotions are not us, but are just all things that are known and observed. Then, eventually, we start to notice that sometimes the mind is the stable observer, and sometimes it is just a thinker. We will notice that one moment the mind is awake and observing, and the next it is lost in thought. If we practice in this way often, we will wake up to the fact that the mind is always changing states on its own. Seeing clearly and accepting the truth that the body and mind, or physical and mental phenomena, are not us, we enter the stream of enlightenment. When the mind sees clearly that the body is nothing but suffering, it will no longer attach to the body, which means it will not sink into the sense organs and immerse itself in pain and pleasure from the outside world. When we profoundly realize that both body and mind are nothing but suffering, we will let go of attachment to them. The mind will be completely free of any impurities and no longer suffer. Such is the mind of an Arahant, one who has fully enlightened. Chapter 3. Practicing Vipassana. To practice Vipassana, we need to have the mindfulness that knows the body and knows the mind as they really are in the present moment. If we are to practice Vipassana correctly, we have to first learn to be aware of our body and mind. Secondly, we have to let the body and mind do what they do naturally, so that we can see them demonstrate their true three characteristics: that nothing is permanent, that nothing is satisfactory, and that nothing can be controlled. Practicing to develop mindfulness, we need to be aware and know what this mind and body are doing as often as possible. The enemy of mindfulness is mindlessness, being lost in whatever we are doing without awareness. We can be lost in thinking, or lost in what we see or what we hear. Another enemy of mindfulness is focusing in on the body or focusing in on the mind. This is a measure of controlling the body and mind, interfering with their natural states. When we control them, it becomes hard to see their true characteristics. When we know what our mind is doing, we will not be lost in our thoughts. We will wake up out of thought and be on the right track for Vipassana practice. Once we are awake and out of our thoughts, our duty is to then have the correct type of concentration, the stable observer, to see what the mind and body really are and how they really are, without interfering with their behavior. We will see their true characteristics and thus be walking the path of wisdom. We will be practicing Vipassana. Being truly awake, we are out of the make-believe world of our thoughts and dreams. We enter reality, the world of the truth, of the way things really are. This is the essential access point to Vipassana. One thing that most Dhamma practitioners are missing and need to work harder at is achieving correct concentration. Many people practice meditation incorrectly and don't have the correct type of concentration. They can't differentiate between which type of concentration is useful and which is not. If we don't have the correct type of concentration, then we will not see the true three characteristics. Only correct concentration or samadhi is what gives rise to wisdom into the true nature of things. Let's take a moment now and concentrate on the in and out breath. Let's put some effort in and intend to stay with the breath. Can we see that we know what the breath is doing? That's our mindfulness. Our mindfulness is being held at the breath. And there is concentration too. But notice that the mind has slipped down and is holding to the breath. It is not the stable knower of the breath, but it has moved down into it. Wisdom cannot arise this way. When most meditators watch the breath, their minds are pinned to the breath. When they watch the arising and falling of the abdomen, their minds are held at the abdomen. When they watch their feet lifting and moving during walking meditation, their minds are held down in their feet. In all of these examples, the mind is lost in the sense that it is not aware it is being sent down to the meditation object. These are examples of samatha practice, where the mind is held at an object to be calm for a while. It is not the correct type of concentration that leads to wisdom. No wisdom will arise from doing samatha, just a mind that is rendered motionless. A mind that has correct concentration is light, gentle, nimble, and it is certain and honest regarding everything it observes. When anger or greed arises, we know that it has, and it is seen as if it is just a person walking past our house. When the mind wanders off in thought, we are the stable observer of this again and again, as if we are seeing someone else's mind that keeps wandering off. We know happily, and we know comfortably. For those who watch the breath and send their mind out to the breath to watch it, the breath and the mind will appear as one process. There will be no space between the two. This is a practice of focusing in, of samatha. If the mind is the stable observer, it will see the body breathing as if it is at a distance, like someone else's body breathing. Sometimes the mind will move down into the body or to the breath, and sometimes it will move around elsewhere. If we are able to know when the mind moves here and there, the mind will become the stable observer again and again. When we are the stable observer and aware of the body and mind, we will see immediately that the body that moves around is not us. We will also see that the happy and unhappy and neutral feelings that we experience are not us. We will know these things are not us because they are at a distance. Just like a table or a chair. No one thinks that a table is us. Can we see how this works? When the mind is stable and there is mindfulness and wisdom, we will feel that our hand is not us, but something at a distance. In fact, our entire body will feel this way. The mind is the separate observer of something that is not us, not a person. Most people do not have a stable mind. Their minds are moving around from thing to thing, from story to story, mindlessly and pointlessly. We can call this a restless mind. In contrast, if our mind is being held still at one object, we can call this fixating or over-focusing. The two mistakes which inhibit our vipassana practice are getting lost in thought and fixating or focusing. Our mind at times can be compared to a monkey, swinging from branch to branch, this way and that way, following every thought that passes through. This is a monkey mind, aimlessly swinging from here to there without awareness, lost in whatever arises. It is busy and restless. At other times, when we want the mind to behave, we move towards one particular object and stick to it. It is like Tarzan or the monkey now deciding to remain frozen, holding to one branch, not moving anywhere else. This is samatha. This is over-focusing, where wisdom has no chance of arising. The Buddha's famous middle way is the place where the mind is neither lost in wherever thought takes us, nor forcing the mind to be under control by holding focus or holding it still. How can we find this middle way, where we are not lost and not controlling? There are many different types of personalities, and so there are also many different ways to achieve a stable mind in order to attain wisdom. One way is to do deep absorption meditation, or jhana. For this practice, we need to watch an object like the in-and-out breath. We should watch the breath in a relaxed and comfortable way. We should not squeeze, push, or force the mind to try to make it still or to stick to the breath. It doesn't like to be forced. Forcing it will cause stress and will never create a place of peace. If we keep observing the breath in a relaxed way, the breath will slowly get more and more shallow. Eventually, bright light will appear in the mind's eye. The mind or heart will be very happy and filled with joy. Our job at this point is to be mindful of such feelings that arise in the mind or heart. The mind will then relax out of its focus on the light. It will no longer be contemplating it or thinking about it. All that will remain is a oneness of mind, correct samadhi or concentration, the stable observer. No more object will be present, and no more contemplation, only the stable observer. When we exit the deep concentration and come back to the regular world, the oneness of mind, the stable observer, will still be there. It sustains itself without any effort required. The body will be experienced as merely an object of observation. The deep meditation described is ideal, but it is very difficult for modern people with active minds and many responsibilities. If we would like to achieve the stable observer, there is another easier way. We can choose an object of observation, like the breath, the abdomen rising and falling, or perhaps the body in a more general way, watching it stand, sit, walk, and lie down. We can observe that the body is standing, and the mind is the one that knows this. The body sits, and the mind is the one that knows this. The body breathes, and the mind is the one that knows this. Practicing in this way, the mind and the body will separate from each other, and the stable observer will be achieved, though it won't last long. For those of us who cannot accomplish the stable observer in either of the above ways, there is yet another way. Every time mindfulness sees that the mind is moving into thought, the stable observer is achieved for a moment. So it is sufficient to notice the mind going off to think over and over again, and the stable observer can appear longer. When the stable observer arises, it is as if we are removed from ourself, as if a second person emerges as the watcher. One is the watcher and the other is being watched. The workings of the body and mind all become things that are known or watched. Anything that is being watched is not ourself, right? It is just an object of observation. We start walking the path of wisdom when we are able to separate out the things that we take to be ourself. In short, all aspects of the body and mind, which includes what we might call the heart as well. When we develop to the point where awareness is strong, the things we consider to be ourself will divide up into distinct objects or aggregates for us to see. There will be the body, feelings and sensations, memory and classification, emotions and mental states, and the bare consciousness that is able to know such objects. None of these things contains or comprises a person. But when awareness is lost and they all come together again, we wrongly identify with these aggregates as who we are. Once there is a me, then there becomes an I'm old, I'm sick, and I will die. There becomes a person whose wishes come true or whose hopes and dreams are never realized. There is a me who gets separated from the people and things that I love, and a me who has to encounter people and things that I hate. We suffer because of all of this, of course. But if we can see the truth that there is no me, then there is no longer a me that gets old, gets sick, and dies. There is just a body that gets old, sick, and dies. There will never be a me that gets old, sick, and dies, ever again. Regarding the mind, things are coming and going, changing all of the time. One moment, the mind is thinking something nice. The next, it is thinking something mean. One moment, it is happy, and the next, it is upset. One moment, it is angry, the next, greedy, and the next, it is lost in thought. It works all by itself, beyond anyone's control. Things are coming in and leaving all of the time. It is not us. This is what we do. We observe this body and see that it isn't us. We observe this mind and see that it is not us. There is no us. There are just groupings or aggregates of phenomena. When the aggregates separate out for us to see, we see that not one of them is a person. They are but phenomena, natural processes. The mind appears to be running around from here to there, but this is just an illusion. A cartoon is a succession of frames arising and falling, and so are the workings of the mind. In reality, the mind arises and falls very quickly in succession. We keep seeing and understanding the truth more and more. The mind will see that happiness and unhappiness are temporary states. Anger, greed, and the wandering mind are all temporary states. Everything is temporary. Whatever arises also falls. When the mind finally accepts the truth that anything that arises is just a temporary phenomenon, the mind will surrender. It will no longer struggle in pursuit of satisfaction or enjoyment in any object. It will no longer struggle to push away or avoid any object that can bring displeasure. The mind will become genuinely indifferent to what arises. This indifference arises from wisdom, not from any kind of suppression or tranquility training. It is a powerful kind of indifference or neutrality that can be better defined as an equanimity to all formations. At this point, pleasure and pain are equivalent states. So are heaven and hell. All states are seen as equivalent. Pleasure or happiness, when it arises, is merely known or seen. Pain or suffering, when it arises, is merely known or seen. There will be no struggle and no forming of any stories or fictions. The mind will gradually slow its forming of fictions until it suddenly halts to a stop. When the mind stops, it will enter a deep level of concentration automatically. Enlightening wisdom will arise, and impurities will be washed away from the mind forevermore. Nirvana will be experienced. At this point, the mind will come out of the deep concentration and return to the regular world. If final enlightenment has taken place, there will be no defilements or impurities remaining in the mind. The experience of nirvana is whole and complete. Nirvana is here and now, and has never gone anywhere. It is right in front of our eyes. but we cannot see it as we are blinded by impurities, misperceptions, by ignorance. When we walk the path of wisdom and practice vipassana to the fullest, we receive the greatest gift available to any being. Nirvana is complete liberation, weightless and released from any desire, with no more attachment, no more struggle, and never again deluded. The mind is untouchable. Nothing can ever come in, take over the mind, and make it suffer ever again. Chapter 4. Dhamma in Daily Life. Once we understand the proper principles of Dhamma, it is time to put the teachings to practice in our daily lives. Let's get rid of the image that many of us have in our heads, that a good Vipassana or Dhamma practitioner sits cross-legged, with the eyes and ears closed. The most important part of the practice is mindfulness throughout our regular activities in daily life. Whenever an impurity arises in the mind, we know that it has right then and there, irrespective of what else we may be doing at the time. Now, when we are at work, we should be focused on our duties at hand. However, if we have a few minutes here and there with nothing to do, we can immediately start to watch the body and mind. Or while at work, if stress enters the mind, we can know that stress has arisen. That is Dhamma practice, right then and there. Perhaps we are hurrying to complete a project, and then someone calls and is wasting our time. Our mind feels angry. We then can practice mindfulness and know that anger has arisen. Then we keep working away until we look at the clock and see it is lunchtime. Satisfaction arises, and we become aware and see that it has. This is what a true Dhamma practitioner does. Next, we go downstairs for lunch and walk along and watch the body walking. The mind is the observer, and the body is being observed. What to eat? There are so many great choices today. We must be very hungry as everything looks wonderful. The mind is indecisive. We know that it is. On some days, nothing at all looks appetizing, and the mind feels annoyed. This cafeteria sucks. Can't they be more original? If we don't have mindfulness, the hungrier we are, the more we complain. Sometimes we have to use the washroom really badly. We run to the washroom and see that all the stalls are full. We really start to worry. We notice that this worry has arisen. If we can have the mindfulness that sees the anxiety, then our stomach may be in pain, but our mind will not be. This is Dhamma practice. We watch our mind and see what happens moment to moment. Soon, we will see that our mind is always in flux. One moment it is happy, and the next it is unhappy, and then the next it is neutral. One moment the mind is wholesome and joyfully practicing the Dhamma, and the next moment it is struggling, lost in a painful story. Can we see this? The mind in a flash changes from greedy to angry and then often thought. We are not practicing to be superhuman. We are just to be ordinary people like we are now. We keep practicing in daily life to see what an ordinary human body and mind are like, what their true characteristics are. When we understand their true characteristics, we won't be upset when this or that happens to the body and mind. Getting old is normal, getting sick is normal, and dying is normal. Not getting what we want is normal. Getting what we don't want is normal. Dreams coming true, dreams shattered, are all normal and natural experiences. We cannot depend on this body and this mind. They cannot bring us any comfort or happiness that we can truly rely on. Accepting this, whatever happens in our life will appear as if it is happening to someone else and not us. We break free from the cycle of karma, one could say. There is tremendous relief and incomparable happiness when we are no longer living in the delusion that there is a self. With full wisdom, it is the aggregates and not us that move about functionally, doing this and that. And if there are just aggregates and the idea of a me is just a delusion, then who suffers? The body and mind may suffer, but we certainly don't. We become free from suffering because we have a correct understanding of the way things are. We have enlightened wisdom. The cycle of birth and death is a very long and painful one. It is a very rare occurrence that a being will have the chance to listen to and become interested in the Dhamma that liberates us from this cycle of suffering once and for all. Let's not spend our time mindlessly and without meaning. Let's gradually bring awareness to our body and mind and practice the Buddhist way to peace of mind.